Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. This week, we reach beyond our studios and bring you interviews from Wyoming PBS's Wyoming Chronicle. A young park ranger came to Wyoming and established the state's chapter of Women Who Hike.
And so just all of those elements that I'm so proud of for Wyoming, I wanted to bring that emphasis with Women Who Hike that's for women.
An energy-efficient house designed by University of Wyoming students won second place in the annual Global Solar Decathlon.
It definitely is, and that's what we wanted to focus on, was making sure that every Wyomingite would want to be here and want to live here.
Join us for those stories on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Angelina Stancampiano, thanks for being with us on Wyoming Chronicle. How long have you been with the state of Wyoming State Parks?
I've been a ranger with Wyoming State Parks for 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Before that, you worked in Oklahoma.
I was a ranger there for 3 years.
You began your career there. What sort of something that as a child you thought of doing a lot? One day I want to be a state park interpretive ranger in Wyoming, or how specific did it get?
My dad is a biology professor, and so every walk in the woods was a guided hike for my brothers and I, and we didn't even realize that's what it was. We thought everyone's dad knew everything about the ecosystem, and the farther I went into school, I realized what an anomaly that was, and how I had peers and classmates who didn't have that experience, and so that started me down the path of maybe this is something that I could do too. I could connect people with nature as well.
So that's what you're doing now. You're the person who gives the guided walk and knows everything about what's being seen in nature. So the degree that you have is what?
Biology.
And where'd you get it?
Oklahoma City University.
Is that the type of training that someone who becomes a state parks ranger typically has? A biology degree is a common enough pathway to it?
Yes. What I like most about what I do is that it's skills from all different realms. And I went to a liberal arts school. And so I took public speaking, and I took arts and culture, and I took all of these creative writing courses. And so it was a well-rounded education. I also took organic chemistry and biochemistry. And so you can go the biology route, history. Some people come up through parks and recreation, but I was science focused.
So in your job now as an interpretive ranger, you came to Wyoming to do that position. What's the general job description?
I say that it is translating the natural and cultural resources of a site to visitors. So having that knowledge and presenting it to them in a way that they're engaged and that they care about these sites as well.
So you said a site. Now you have some responsibility or oversight or programming duties for more than one site. What's your realm, your bailiwick, so to speak?
We have the Shoshone District, which is southwest Wyoming. So I have here at South Pass City and Fort Bridger Historic Site are my two historic sites. Mm-hmm. And then Bear River in Evanston, Seminole outside of Rawlins, and Sinks Canyon in Lander.
And you live at Sinks Canyon, you were telling me.
I do.
Year round?
Yes.
So this is your, and so we're sort of in your workplace here now.
Yes, workplace, home, all of it in one.
I get the impression from talking to you that that's a fun job to have.
It is.
What are you liking about it 5-6 years into your career?
I love that with each program, I can still see the spark in someone. I can share a fact that I've known for years and that I've shared hundreds of times, but connecting that one person with that fact about a site and seeing them light up about it fuels me doing this 6 years in.
We're here today. We happen to be at South Pass City State Historic Site. I don't know how many state parks and state historic sites under the State Parks Department division that there are. Do you by any chance?
Around 32.
Yeah, I was going to say it's more than a couple dozen, so it's more than a few. And one thing that has always stuck out to me, when you look at a list of what the parks are, where they are, when they're open, and what you can do there, you could have a lot of fun almost year-round doing the state park event circuit, couldn't you?
Yes, a lot of people say, oh, you live in Wyoming, so are you off all winter? But we lead guided tours. We'll go snowshoeing mm-hmm. with classrooms. We will go caving. We even had a Women Who Hike event where we went ice skating, ice fishing, and snowshoeing.
And there's the First Day Hikes program. Have you been involved in that?
Yes, January 1st. It's a nationwide initiative mm-hmm. through the National Association for State Park Directors. And we have them here in Wyoming, and sometimes they are with snowshoes.
Now, you mentioned Women Who Hike, and that's one of your particular areas of emphasis. Tell us what, it's a national initiative that you're localizing. Is that a good way to put it?
Yes, it was co-founded about 6 years ago, mm-hmm. and it was co-founded by a woman named Nicole, who thought she was the only woman that enjoyed the outdoors. And so she set off to make it into a collaborative effort. And now every state has a chapter. I am the ambassador for Wyoming, so I create programming under Women Who Hike here in Wyoming.
And that's one of the things you came to Wyoming to do. You knew you were going to be involved in Women Who Hike. And what was the first Women Who Hike program you put together in our state?
We put together one at Seminole, mm-hmm. which is about 37 miles from Rawlins. It's not a park you happen onto.
And its foundation is the big reservoir there, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so if you have a boat or you have a trailer, you might have set out to go to Seminole. Mm-hmm. But day hikers and other folks maybe have never discovered the secret gem of a park. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to emphasize that park and create an opportunity for people to mm-hmm. come and enjoy.
What are the hidden secrets of Seminole, for example? What's the sort of thing that you want people to know about?
So we brought in canoes, and we canoed across the reservoir and went hiking. So there's not any trails currently within the park, but we took the opportunity to go across that big famed reservoir and hike on the other side.
I see. Canoeing, part of your bio degree at Oklahoma City U.
Yeah.
Was it?
I mean, I canoed and kayaked for a job fresh out of college. That was part of my...
So you aren't, when you say women who hike, it's women who canoe and...
Ice fish and ice fish. Skate and cave and...
You do all that stuff.
Yeah.
Good. So we're now here, it's in late July, last weekend of July, at South Pass City State Historic Site. What is Women Who Hike history about here?
This is the first ever history kind of thematic approach to a Women Who Hike. Mm. I am especially proud of South Pass City's history involving women's rights.
I think a lot of people who watch Wyoming Chronicle might know about that, but maybe they don't. What do you mean by that?
Esther Hobart Morris served as Justice of the Peace here. She was the first female public officer. And
not just at South Pass City, in the United States.
In the United States. And then I'm sure everyone's aware we're the equality state, women's suffrage. Wyoming had the right to vote for women before statehood. And so just all of those elements that I'm so proud of for Wyoming, I wanted to bring that emphasis with Women Who Hike that's for women.
Yeah, it's a great place to do it. I mean, Esther Morris, as people know, I think, and are about to know, she got the position of Justice of the Peace in South Pass City when it was a rollicking gold mining camp, and the other residents of the town picked her to do it, wanted her to do it.
Right, and that's something that's really important to me. With Women Who Hike, it's not anti-men or excluding men. It's the combination, it's the being welcomed into the outdoor world. And so it was a man who put her up for the position, just like I have male bosses who make it possible for us to have these.
And this was in a time when this idea was fairly radical. 1867, I believe, was the year, not a time when you might have guessed that this would happen. What do you know about why she was deemed the person for the job?
She was handpicked, as far as I know. So the population wasn't huge here, but she was chosen to serve in that role. And she did for only a short time, a few months. But what a cool place to have it happen.
And as you get deeper into the Women Who Hike History program, for example, or other programs too, if you need regional or outside authorities to come in and supplement what you're teaching, you do that. In fact, that's what's happening here, right?
Yes, Site Superintendent Joe Ellis mm-hmm. will be doing a program tonight.
He knows all about Esther Morris.
He does. And then we'll have a Continental Divide Trail through hiker that will be helping us on the trail in the morning. So I don't know everything, as you said earlier.
But you're that's a big part of what you do is facilitate, introduce, connect, whether it's the nature, history, or people who can help you. What would a typical Women Who Hike program be like? Is it just an afternoon? Is it an overnight thing, or does it depend?
It's typically a whole weekend. As you know, here in Wyoming, you have to set out, make a little drive to just about anywhere. So we like to make it that whole weekend so that women come from Utah, Colorado, and all over the state to spend close to 48 hours together.
So we're here on a Friday, on a typical Women Who Hike weekend. Participants would arrive on Friday afternoon or evening.
Mm-hmm.
What's the first night typically like?
Setting up tents, helping one another. Sometimes we have first-time hikers or first-time campers, so we show them how to set up a tent, a good spot, make sure to put your rain fly on, cook dinner, usually have a campfire, and kind of create that community going into the weekend.
So it's not exactly wilderness roughing it, but it's they're not staying in a hotel room either.
Right. We're all tent camping, but we do have some nice kitchen setups, and we eat pretty well.
So after the first night in the campsite around the campfire with a good meal, then I haven't heard anything about hiking yet. I'm presuming that starts the next day.
Yes, Saturday is usually our big hike day. Mm-hmm. Get up, have a good breakfast, go over some group rules, group vibes, what we hope to get out of the weekend, and then set off on a hike.
People who've signed up for it, I think, they're not surprised to hear what you've said. They're up for this. But it's not just a stroll in the park either. You're going to do some work?
Usually a couple miles.
What's another Women Who Hike program that you've done in Wyoming, or a couple that you still want to do?
We had a really fun one this winter. I turned to a district manager for another district, and I said, hey, when are we going to have one in your district? And he said, this winter. I said, we can't have a camp out in the winter. And we did. So we stayed in cabins at Boyson. And that district manager, Brooks Jordan, taught wintertime survival. And the crew at Boyson, the superintendent, John Bass, they built a skating rink on Boyson Reservoir for us. Game and Fish worked with us, and two game wardens came and taught us how to ice fish with all the gear. And then we also had snowshoes for the whole group and just had a really unique time being able to appreciate the outdoors even with several feet of snow.
Yeah, it's a harsh, harsh winter, especially in most of Wyoming, but especially there. So that took some doing. How was the turnout for it?
We sold out within 48 hours.
Selling out meant how many?
Nine women. Yep, we capped it at nine women to be able to stay in those cabins.
How many will be at South Pass City this weekend?
We'll have 11 here. We had 16 for our Leave No Trace trainers course that we taught a few weeks ago.
And that's part of Women Who Hike also?
Mm-hmm.
All right, better tell us about that.
An all-women Leave No Trace trainers course, co-taught by Nicole Brown, the Women Who Hike co-founder. So she flew in from Oregon, and the two of us taught the course over the weekend.
And Leave No Trace, I think I know what you mean, but you better tell me.
So Leave No Trace is a now global initiative for us to be the best stewards of the land possible. There are seven principles that are kind of like the guiding outline for how to recreate responsibly.
I'm assuming then that the seven principles you're talking about, even if, for example, Women Who Hike History is not a Leave No Trace event, but those principles will be in place for what you're doing. In that case, let's test you. What are the seven?
One is know before you go, plan ahead and prepare. Mm-hmm. Two is camp and hike on durable surfaces. Three is dispose of waste properly. Four is leave what you find. Five is campfire safety. Six is respect wildlife. And seven is respect other visitors.
A lot there.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it's common sense, but my experience has been, I thought I knew what I was doing or the way to proceed or the way to act, and I didn't always.
And Leave No Trace does research. So sometimes what was the right thing to do 10 years ago, now new research has come out and it's not. And it's not a way of enforcing or writing tickets. It's just a way of further educating people so that they can be the best stewards when they're on our public lands.
Any other Women Who Hike events in Wyoming that you've done or that you're looking forward to doing?
We had one last fall, and we'll do it again this year for National Public Lands Day at Sinks Canyon State Park.
What would be your ambition for the program statewide? I know you mentioned that you call another district and said we'd like to do one there. Something you'd like to grow to corner to corner?
Yes, there's really cool sites throughout the state, and it really started as hiking, like we said, and it's really morphed into this women's empowerment, women getting together to enjoy the outdoors. And I've heard feedback that they want a fly fishing women's weekend. Really? So that might be on the radar.
What will you tell the visitor, the participants tonight as they arrive as an introduction?
Luckily, at this point, that's become easy because I have so many repeat participants. So this is our fifth Women Who Hike event. Mm-hmm. And I had a woman who attended the first four. She attended three of the first four. And I have one coming today that this will be her third. And then I have, I think, five others. This will be their second.
So these are people that you get to know, become mm-hmm. friends of yours, friends with each other. That's got to be a gratifying part of the program, too.
It is. My best friend in Wyoming, I met through Women Who Hike.
Is that so? At the end of the Women Who Hike event, whether it's this one or another one, what do you want the participants to have gained and to leave with?
It seems trite, but I like to say empowering women. Mm-hmm. So for them to leave and feel comfortable in the outdoors after we go over what to pack, how to be safe on the trail, the Leave No Trace principles. A lot of times they're already doing those things, but they just need someone in a uniform to say, you're doing a great job. Yeah. And then they can go out and use our public lands well. I also hope that they leave with better knowledge and understanding and maybe appreciation for our agency. I think that that human connection, mm-hmm. that I can wear both hats as a Women Who Hike ambassador and a park ranger. I've had a lot of feedback like, before I never thought to tell a park ranger I was going to be out on a hike all day alone. But now after meeting you all, mm-hmm. now I always tell them where I'm going and it makes me feel a lot safer on the trails.
Interesting. And that, I mean, so many things are politicized these days, and you use the word empowerment, which in some context and to some people has this connotation. You're not talking about that at all. For example, knowing to tell someone where you're going to make yourself safer. That's
right,
part of
empowering them to go out on their own. Mm-hmm. And just with, like you said, just those little bits of information that they might not have thought of before, mm-hmm. or maybe they're already doing, but just hearing someone say that's the right thing to be doing.
What are you looking forward to the most, or what's the best part of a Women Who Hike weekend for you, can you say?
It's day two, once everyone's settled in, and I can look around and they're all talking and laughing with one another. We've been together for a day and they've already created new friends. And just knowing that all the work I put into it is worth it in that moment, those are my favorite points of the weekend.
We've been watching you and your fellow, your seasonal coworker Wyatt here today, unloading a lot of stuff, getting a lot of preparation in the hours before anyone even arrives. In terms of your field, your specialty, your science, you make a point of pointing a lot of things out to the participants.
Oh, yes. They get packing lists. They know everything ahead of time. And then when they get here, every place that we go is a guided hike. Yeah.
You've mentioned that it's a fairly small group. What if someone who hasn't done it, and it's even a smaller group considering how many people try to redo it, someone who wants to do it for the first time, how do they get involved?
We open up registration online, so you can see it through Women Who Hike or through Wyoming State Parks. And it's not super strenuous hiking. So if you're, you know, a 3 to 4 mile hike kind of gal, you're more than welcome to come. Mm-hmm. We had a woman at our last campout who had never been camping in her life, and she had a great time and wants to come back. Great. So your skill level, we have the whole spectrum, and we accommodate all kinds of dietary restrictions, any accessibility issues. I send out a questionnaire before, and I invite women to share anything they want with me. So sometimes it's fear of spiders. Sometimes it's that they're new and don't have any friends in Wyoming.
So no one has to have a tarantula on her arm if she would rather not?
They don't have to. It is sometimes encouraged with snakes.
One of the options. So if you're a rugged outdoors person who's used to a lot more strenuous hiking than this, I'm sure up here around South Pass City State Historic Site, someone, that person could find something that she could do that would be a little beyond what your programmed event is. But you'll take it easy on someone else if that's what's required.
Yes, a lot of the women will take Friday off of work too and add in another element. So I have a woman coming today, it's her second time, another it's her third time at one of my programs, and they're hiking in the Red Canyon. I've had women stop at Hot Springs in Saratoga or in Thermopolis on their way. And so it's kind of a build your own adventure. I have this set of programming and you can build on if you want to put some more miles in before or after.
Typically, are most of the participants Wyoming people? Do they need to be?
No, we're open to whoever would like to come. The first one I hosted, we didn't have a single Wyoming person. I think in the five total, we have maybe three women that have been born and raised in Wyoming. So a lot of time it's women who have moved here who are looking to make new friends. Mm-hmm. We even had someone, she came to her second and had her friend from Arkansas fly in to be a participant too.
Really? They enjoyed it?
She did. Even though it was cold and she's not a cold weather person, she had a fantastic time.
Is there a cost to participating?
There is. There's a cost that covers food, mm-hmm. and basic supplies. We keep the cost low just to cover. There's no money.
It's not a money maker for the division.
Nope. And it's all through Women Who Hike, which is a 501c3. So they handle all of the registration and the purchasing of all of those supplies.
What's a typical sitting around the campfire Women Who Hike supper like?
So usually day two, like I was talking about, my peak time, someone else is cooking because I'm tired and they've all become friends and they've taken over the grill. And so there's usually some cooking conversation going on and then some around the fire conversation, mm-hmm. and swapping good trails, good sites that they've visited. And I really count on those women who are repeats sharing some tales of, oh, you should go to Boysen. You would not believe how fun Boysen was. And then these women are saying, okay, will you host Boysen again next year? A lot of outdoors talk.
Do you find that the participants keep in touch with you or with each other in between times?
Yes, both. We just last weekend had a woman who lives in Laramie, and she was coming through the Lander area, and she called up these three ladies we call the Golden Girls, and they met at Lander Bar and had some beers, and I had a program the next morning, and they were out too late for me, but they were getting together, they invited me, we all keep in touch. It's a really fun community.
I get the feeling you're loving this job, but it's a busy job. You do a lot. What are some other things you've done, say, this summer besides get ready for Women Who Hike?
So just this summer, we've hosted a series of campouts with Women Who Hike, but also with Latino Outdoors. We work with our great friend Cassie and host the events together to actively invite underrepresented groups into parks. So we had a whole Spanglish weekend just 2 weeks ago at Sinks Canyon, where they rock climbed, and we had great time cooking out, sitting around the fire. Cassie attended my trainer's course, so she taught Leave No Trace in Spanish to participants, which was really cool to see the fruition of that work. I also have been working on a $40,000 pollinator grant statewide.
Pollinator.
Positively impacting pollinators through demonstration gardens and through visitor education. So we have sites at Bear River, Ednis Kimball Wilkins, at Keyhole, at Kurt Gowdy, and at Medicine Lodge. And then we also have a victory garden at Camp Douglas.
So people thinking about the large, mostly square shape of Wyoming, you are going border to border just for this program alone.
Yes, we have five districts. And so my goal was to have one demonstration site per district. We have a poster campaign as part of it, a beautiful poster made by a local Lander artist. And we've been making seed bombs. We've been doing all kinds of really cool pollinator programming.
The impression I'm getting then, there's just lots of areas of interest and types of work that come into this all together. You talked about artists, you've talked about cooks, you've talked about pollinators, you've talked about...
I just got an inspiring message from the printer in Lander who told me to have a great weekend. I've spent so much time at the printer printing Junior Ranger books and pollinator posters. I work with a lot of different types of people.
Sure you do. That's good for the State Parks Division. And just to show people what goes on there. Again, the variety of fun things to do compares favorably to standing in a long line somewhere out of state to do something for 2 minutes.
We had a really cool program this week that I've been working on for about a year and a half with a deaf child. Her mom contacted us last year, saw some of my programming and wanted to know how to be a part. So we've been working for a year and a half. We had 4 programs this week in the Bighorn District with an American Sign Language interpreter for the one child. And that's how we function in Wyoming State Parks. Our mission is to improve communities and enrich lives.
You get freedom, I imagine, to do, you can do what you want in your field.
Yes. I had this inquiry from a person that needed American Sign Language interpreter. And I sent an email to the deputy directors and the director telling them, this is what we have to do. This is what ADA says. You know, you guys have to do this. And my deputy director replied and he said, I don't care what we have to do. This is what we should be doing. And that totally changed my mindset of working for the government. And I tell people that and I think about that line all the time because that's how I felt with every program. It's not me having to try and validate what I'm doing. They say, yep, great idea. Let me know how I can help. Let me know how I can fund it.
Angelina, thanks for being with us on Wyoming Chronicle. I know it's going to be a fun weekend and a fun year ahead for Women Who Hike.
Thanks, Steve.
More than 900 college and university teams compete in the biennial Solar Decathlon, a global competition sponsored by the U.S. Department of Energy. It invites contestants to create the most energy-efficient house possible with solar power as the foundation. In 2023, a team from the University of Wyoming completed its 5-semester competition in the Decathlon Challenge, and the student-designed house that now stands in the foothills of the Wind River Mountains near South Pass placed second among all the U.S. houses in the contest and fourth in the world. The contest has 2 primary divisions, one theoretical, judged as a design on paper, and the other a practical competition based not just on design, but on construction of the house as well. Allie Carlo, a master's degree candidate in architectural engineering, is one of the student solar decathlon team members.
The design is all theoretical, so schools across the country and all across the world can design whatever they want. They have several different divisions, from education to just a home, that they won't ever get built.
Actually, building the structure is a source of pride for the student team, and it took innovative mechanical problem solving to achieve it. Much of that work fell to Emmanuel Idio, a visiting student from Nigeria. He's pursuing a PhD in mechanical engineering at the university.
You get to see those mechanical systems in work and kind of see how they help keep the climate or the temperature of the house within the desired limits. And I think that's very interesting, seeing how this, whatever you've designed, seeing how it works in like real life.
Real life, that's an important consideration because this is not simply an academic exercise. The innovative design and structure met all 10 criteria set out by the Solar Decathlon, and the UW team placed first in 3 of those categories. But the Wyoming designers added their own internal benchmark as well. Their house had to be buildable, affordable, and livable for a typical Wyoming family. UW professor Tony Denzer is one of the faculty advisors on the Decathlon project.
It's a real-world project, and the students designed from the beginning needed to meet the rigors of the marketplace, because we knew that this house was going to be built on spec by a home builder who was going to put it on the market at the end of the project. And so the house really had to appeal to Wyoming homeowners.
Well, I'm looking at the 10 parts that constitute the Solar Decathlon. Market is one of the required elements, at least it's supposed to be. Play a role in this.
Yeah, it definitely is, and that's what we wanted to focus on, was making sure that every Wyomingite would want to be here and want to live here, and that was a big part of why we chose things that we wanted.
Not everybody's going to build this house or buy this house. There's only one of these. You could try to build something like it or close to it, but everyone would want to do it. That's at least the goal that you had.
And it's a Wyoming house. It's in
what
the
do you mean by that?
It's in the sort of style of the Mountain West, so the exterior appearance with the wood siding fits nicely in the Wyoming landscape. And in terms of programming the house, when you walk in the front door, we have this really generous mudroom with some built-in furniture, so a place to take off your boots and your coat. When you live in a rural site like this in Wyoming, that's a must. So that house is really tailored to the Wyoming marketplace.
We're outside Lander, up in the beginning to climb up into the Wind River Mountains, near an area known as Red Canyon, which is familiar to travelers and Fremont County residents. One of the beautiful places in all of the Americas, and that's where this house happens to be built. Why did we choose this location?
Well, we're really lucky to be designing for such a spectacular site, and we're partnered with a private home builder, Corey Toy, and his family, Tim Shell Construction. He identified the land and purchased it, and it's rather extraordinary kind of risk on his part to commit, as he did 2.5 years ago, to build a student-designed house. And so the partnership is really the centerpiece of this story, and so much great education on the part of the students is owed to Corey and his partnership with UW.
You know, a phrase that I've heard used in other fields and have used myself: form must follow function. If it doesn't work as a house, who cares how it works as a contest entry, really.
And even more than that, the character of the form is really that there are two sloping roofs. One is sloped up, and that's for passive solar heating. So we have a lot of glass up on the second level of the roof. The other roof is sloping down towards the south, and that's to accommodate the solar panels. So the passive solar and active solar, that really drove the shape of the house.
When I think of passive solar heat, I think of sitting by the window on a sunny day in January, feeling warmer. But active solar power is more than that, clearly.
Yes, so in terms of active solar power, we have the solar panels to be able to help us harness that and help take that active solar and help us store that. So we have like batteries to help us store that energy. But also going back to that passive solar is also very important in terms of like the type of windows you have within your construction, and also our flooring. So we have finished concrete to be able to help us harness or maximize that passive solar. And our high performance windows also helps us keep that heat. So when in the middle of winter, when you want some warmth, like a higher temperature, windows are able to help us keep that heat within the building and help us maximize that passive solar also.
Someone said that, in fact, the anticipated heat delivery for this house is half passive, right?
On a sunny, cold winter day, we're going to get about half of our heat from the south-facing windows. And we experienced that in March when the house was essentially finished in terms of the envelope.
During that time, the average outdoor temperature was around 27 degrees Fahrenheit.
27 outside.
Yeah, and then the average indoor was around 64, 66 degrees Fahrenheit.
But I think every homeowner has at least thought of the idea of, well, one day I'm going to set up a solar array of solar panels in my yard, and we'll generate our own electricity. That's not what you did here. The idea was, we're going to build a house in which the solar panels are part of the construction, which we'll see.
Yeah, and that's a big part of our design with the solar panels is Berg a couple years ago actually did a research.
Berg.
Yes, Berg, it's the Building Energy Research Group. Yeah, and so they did a study, a nationwide study, and basically they surveyed a lot of homeowners who were building and what they would prefer in how their solar panels were arranged on the rooftop and if it was integrated into it versus it was just kind of sporadically placed where to get the optimum. And they found that homeowners would rather see it integrated into the design. And so that's why we placed them where they are on the roof.
Is that necessarily a requirement of the competition or just the way that we just
The only requirement of the competition is to have solar panels. Mm-hmm. That is it. And after that, everything is up to us.
One of the 10 contests was judged by a jury for architecture and the aesthetic, the overall aesthetics of the house. That was one of the 10 competitions, and so we presume that the solar panels being sort of integrally designed and well fitted to the home contributed to that.
We go outside and look around. I'm sure you're proud of how it looks. It's nice.
Yeah.
It's not a box. It's not a trailer with an array of panels beside it. It's a house that looks good in its setting.
What do you see fairly frequently is a new suburban development where the homes have, you know, a multiple roof configuration. Then they come in and add solar panels after the fact. They haven't been part of the architectural design. And it has a very, you know, sort of clumsy appearance.
Almost an afterthought.
Right.
The solar panels, the primary source of the active solar heat, are up on top here. We'll get a better view of that. But they've been angled again to maximize Wyoming's sunshine all year round. They're not being adjusted by the season in some way, are they?
No, not at all. What we did instead was we turned the house 15 degrees southeast. Yeah. And so that optimized it enough. We are already overproducing to help compensate for an electric vehicle or something like that.
I'll quickly run through the list of the 10 parts of the decathlon. Architecture, engineering, market analysis, durability and resistance, embodied environmental impact, someone's gonna have to tell me about that one, integrated performance, occupant experience, comfort and environmental quality, energy performance, and presentation. So there are all factors in this. Some contest decathlon entries were stronger in some parts of this than others. What are the strengths of this house as relates to that list?
So in terms of the strengths, all of those measured categories were like all of our strengths, especially for comfort, for occupant comfort for the house. So in that composition, we are supposed to maintain the temperatures within a particular range, and this is cold Wyoming. So we are still able to maintain within 68 to 74 degrees all through the competition.
Well, you've touched on something I think a lot of people around our state experience when they try to really weather tighten the house during the winter. A couple of things happen. There's condensation appears. You can get almost a vapor lock because the house wasn't built to do that. So you're talking about, this is a house about, must be nearly about as tight as you could get. Insulation, good windows, good doors, a huge part of it clearly, yet that doesn't happen here.
We were named the tightest house in Wyoming by the Aero Barrier contractor who does a lot of these houses. So
the air, the warm air that you don't want to get out stays in, but you're not in a CO2 chamber either. It's comfortable to live in.
Mm-hmm.
Any new house, I don't care if it's a solar decathlon prize winning house or any other build or remodel, the kitchen is just a hugely important part for anyone who's going to live here. So here we can see the nice functional, airy, light design of this kitchen. What about it particularly to the contest is worth pointing out?
Yeah, the big part of the kitchen design was to help with this architecture juried contest and creating a minimally mountain modern design, which was coined by Erica on our team. And so that's where we get a lot of the concrete elements and the wood that's all custom built shelving and things like that, which also helps create this open public area within the house. So that way when you get back into the bedrooms, you feel more like it's a private space, and creating that separation was really important to us from an architecture standpoint.
Looking around this room, which Alec said was the mechanical room, I recognize, I think this is a washer and dryer.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
There's some things in here I don't recognize. Point to a few of them and tell us what we're looking at.
So the main half of the mechanical system is our radiance heating and cooling floor system.
Radiance heating.
So radiance heating and cooling system. So basically, it's this series of pipe that goes all through the floor within the house, underneath the concrete. And that's what really helps us maintain like the temperatures within the house in terms of heating during the winter and cooling during the summer. So this is usually hooked up to our buffer tank, which is hooked up to our heat pump outside. So the air source heat pump helps extract that heat from outside, even at very cold temperatures, because it's a cold climate heat pump, and then transfer that into this radiant heating and cooling system to help us maintain temperatures within the house. So that's one key element there.
One of the advantages of that is if I'm walking around barefoot,
the
floor is warm.
Yeah, so if you wake up very early in the morning on a winter morning and you step out of your bathroom floor, you could step barefoot without slippers.
Was warm bare feet part one of the 10 items on the list? I don't think it was.
Well, it wasn't, but you can also categorize it under comfort and environmental
comfort
quality.
And
yeah.
There we go.
Yeah.
What else?
And then the second part is this, which is our serve units. So like I said, this is a very super tight house, the tightest envelope in Wyoming, but you still need a way to ventilate your house and make sure you have like the best air quality in terms of limiting the carbon dioxide levels. So this system helps us with ventilation. It also helps with, it's also like a redundant system that helps with heating and cooling, but also helps to regulate the humidity levels also. So this brings in fresh air and exchanges the heat with the air already in the house. So it does this energy recovery. So you're not like losing that heat you or the amount of energy you put into the air already in the house. So you're recovering part of that, but you're also bringing in a lot of fresh air.
This is a solar inverter. So it takes the power that we're getting from the solar panels and converts it into the power that we can use on the inside.
And then I think the batteries that we saw just must be right.
Yeah,
the
they're side. Yeah, they're literally sitting right here. So they're getting charged instantaneously.
Also, this is our batteries for our solar panels. So each one is about 7.5 kilowatts kilowatt hours each. So in total, 15 kilowatt hours. And the reason we have it is because we had to design for resiliency. So in cases where you have to, where you go, you don't have to depend on the grid. You have the battery to be able to store whatever solar energy you're able to get from your solar panels. So that stores it in the battery. And if you go off grid or maybe at night, you can take power from the batteries.
So obviously, it's sunny in where we are, but not all the time.
Yeah.
The nights are long in the winter.
Yeah.
And so this is it takes energy generated by the solar panels.
Yeah.
We can use it.
Yeah, we can use it, yeah, to power the house.
One of the sources of the wood is particularly colorful, we learn.
Much of the siding is made out of reclaimed snow fence from Wyoming. Mm-hmm. So the Wyoming Department of Transportation replaces snow fence planks every 10 years, I believe, and they recycle the old planks through a company down in Laramie called Centennial Woods.
So the gray that you see on the side of the house is actually reclaimed snow fence from across Wyoming. We get it from a dealer down in Laramie. And then the black is steel. It's not reclaimed, it's just typical black siding. Mm-hmm. That's steel. But under the roof eaves, that's all beetle kill pine from the Mullen fire.
Really?
Yeah, so that was all reclaimed and milled for us here.
And this all counts towards your credit in the contest, I assume.
Yes.
You're not sawing down new trees and taking them mm-hmm. the lumber yard for
right.
stripping and planing and everything. You're taking what you can get and more or less the form that you find it.
Yeah, and that also contributed to why we chose more wood on the siding versus the metal siding, because it does have a lower carbon footprint. And also, like we said earlier, this is a house in Wyoming. Sure. We want to reflect that.
And this is what it's going to look like, right? You're not going to paint that wood. I mean,
no.
I guess the homeowner could do whatever.
But yeah.
For market, it's going to look like this.
Mm-hmm. We have had a lot of questions in the past about its durability and things like that. But in all honesty, the snow fence wood has already gone through as much of a
it's
test as
yeah. It's not going to be.
Exactly. It's already gone through enough of it that it's not going to, you know, crap out on us at all. So, but even at that, if a panel gets damaged by a summer hailstorm or something like that, you can just order a new plank from Centennial Woods and it's going to flow right into that.
So that material in particular has zero carbon footprint because it's recycled.
When you talk about carbon footprint, you're looking at like, take a steel bracket for example, how much CO2 did it take to get it mined from the field and into production and out to you? And those are all calculated using an EPD, it's an Environmental Product Declaration. Mm-hmm. And so basically it just counts all of that up for you, and you have to go and find these because they're not in industry standard right now. So mm-hmm. it was a little bit of a challenge to come back to that.
I think we did well in that category because we also calculated the total amount of carbon emissions embodied in the construction. We also calculated how many years energy savings in the operation of the house, and it turns out we're going to pay back the carbon footprint of the home in about 8 years by having carbon-free energy.
On a really hot day, what do we do?
Yeah, on a really hot day, you can open the windows and you can also run that in-floor radiant heating also to switches to cooling. So you can cool your floors as well.
Cool water through it and it's also the floor is cool.
Yep.
Does this nice breeze we're feeling, which makes it so much cooler on this side of the house, prevailing most of the time?
Most of the time, yes, if not stronger, which is the advantage of being so high up compared to if we were down in this valley, we would design a lot different.
A lot of these concepts that are at play here have been known about for a long time. They're just being done better here.
Passive solar heating, especially, the idea of orienting the house kind of in a line so that the primary rooms can face south, and using glass on the south that's properly designed in terms of its proportion and properly shaded so that you don't have overheating in the summer. Those principles have been known for almost 100 years, and it's a no-brainer in Wyoming because we're so cold, but we have such an excellent solar resource.
So I see two large tanks here. They have to do with the water supply for the house. How does that work?
Yeah, so these are two cisterns. A lot of the different residents who have built houses around here, they attempted to drill for wells and things like that. And us being so high up, we didn't want to take the chance. And we didn't have room in the budget to take the chance. We'd rather spend that on a guaranteed system. And so instead what we did was we just hauled water from the city of Lander. And it's not an outrageous cost premium to do that, but it was a lot cheaper and a lot more feasible than drilling a well.
It's actually quite commonplace around Wyoming.
Yeah, but that's also why we angled the garage where it is, and this big gap between the house is so that way a delivery truck can come in here. You don't have to attempt to haul water and refill it here.
What's the future of this type of construction? Part of what we're proving here is that it's not radical, it's careful, and there's a future to it.
Yeah, and that was the big part in why we chose a design like this, was because we want people to copy this house. I mean, we put our plans up on our website. You can take these plans, but there are certain aspects that you do need to have somebody look at, and that especially when it comes to passive solar, who can do these energy models. Typical foundations, all slab on grade with a couple of strip footings where needed. And that was a big part too. There was a school who was doing a wood foundation that could barely get it past the codes, and in their area wood just like disintegrates. So we didn't want to do anything that innovative. So again, we want you to copy this.
You talked about the xeriscape approach outside. What do you know about what's going to be done from what in many houses would be taken up by a grass lawn?
Yeah, so out here we're gonna have like railroad tied roundabout kind of style to allow that water truck to come in without any kind of taking out landscape and flowers. But all of the plants that'll be used out here will all be native to the landscape. They're not gonna be things that you need to take care of and use a lot of water, because again, we are on a cistern and we don't want to waste water.
Sure.